depends on our beliefs, what we think. So long as we all believe that fiat money is valuable, it is. This happens all the time. What we believe, what we think we know, can actually cause those things to become true. Actual people, real objects, the way the universe works, and deities like Zeus can exist all by themselves, whether we know about them or believe in them. But some concepts require us to believe in them for them to be real. And if no one believes in them, they literally aren't true. It's called the Tinkerbell effect, and the value of fiat money is an often cited example. But what's really cool is the fact that there are situations where our convictions can actually destroy the very thing we believe in. It's called the reverse Tinkerbell effect, and it describes a situation where as more people believe something, that thing actually becomes less and less true. For example, the idea that driving a car is safe. As more and more people believe this, more people will go out driving, and they are likely to drive less cautiously, ironically making driving less safe. Another example would be the idea that in an election, your vote matters. As more and more people believe this, more people will go out and vote, and the individual weight of each vote will go down. It took hard work and tools to build civilization and find cures and explore our solar system. But we should keep in mind that without doing anything at all, we are still capable of creation. By merely believing in something, we can make it actually, truly real. Other things can actually be destroyed if we merely believe in them. Can you believe that? And as always, thanks for watching.
All right. So that was a piece that, you know, talked about, you know, why money has value. And, we're going to be listening to a piece. It's by the economist Robert Reich. And it talks about, you know, unemployment rates, which, you know, money, jobs, it's all related. So, I just want to remind you again that this, I'm Iris San Giovanni, and with me is Jules Fanard. And call us with any questions, comments, stories. You know, do you have a job? Are you looking for one? We're going to be talking about, you know, college and personal financing, so call us about that too. The number is 780-4909. Again, that's 780-4909. So we're going to go ahead and listen to the piece with Robert Reich.
Hi, I'm Robert Reich, and I want to talk to you about what's really wrong with the economy and why. Now, 4 years into a so-called recovery, and we're still below recession levels in every respect except the stock markets. A measly 88,000 jobs were created in March, and total unemployment remains very high. Employment remains some 3 million below its pre-recession level. Labor force participation is at its lowest since 1979. The recovery isn't just losing steam, it never had much steam to begin with. And that's because so much of our debate over economic policy has been beside the point. On the one side have been Keynesians, followers of the great British economist John Maynard Keynes, who want more government spending and lower interest rates in order to fuel demand. Now, we did try a big Keynesian stimulus between 2009 and 2011, and the Federal Reserve is still keeping interest rates near zero. I do side with the Keynesians, but let's be candid. Keynesians don't have a clear answer for how much additional government spending is necessary in an economy like ours, in which wages keep dropping. And simply urging more is not convincing. On the other side are supply-side austerics, who want lower taxes on the wealthy and on corporations to boost incentives to hire and invest, and who see government deficits crowding out private investment. They've won the latest round by making the Bush tax cuts permanent for 98% of taxpayers, hiking Social Security taxes back up, and implementing the so-called sequester cuts in the face of stubbornly high unemployment. But supply-side austerity doesn't work. George W. Bush tried supply-side tax cuts for the wealthy in 2001 and 2003, and nothing trickled down. In fact, job growth slowed and real wages declined. Austerity economics, meanwhile, has proven a disaster in Europe. Slashing public budgets when unemployment is high and demand already weak has been shown to be a recipe for recession, making public debt even larger relative to the size of the overall economy. Both sides of the modern debate have neglected the elephant in the room, the economic equivalent of an elephant in the room, the scourge of widening inequality. When all of the economic gains go to the top, the rest of the population doesn't have enough purchasing power to keep the economy going. Now, we should have learned this lesson after 1928, when the top 1% got more than 23% of total income. The following year, the economy collapsed. The next time the top 1% got more than 23% of total income was 2007. Businesses won't hire customers, but most Americans can't spend more, and net exports can't possibly make up the difference. And that's why retail sales were down 0.4% in March, and consumer sentiment has fallen to its lowest level in 9 months. The vast middle class in America is running out of money, because real household median income keeps falling. It's down to $45,018 from $51,144 in 2010, and it continues to drop as most of the benefits are going to the top. Declining incomes in the middle, well, that people can't borrow and shouldn't even be borrowing when they have declining incomes. So one important way to get the nation back on track is to restore middle-class prosperity and reverse the trend toward widening inequality. The Great Depression finally ended with the massive Keynesian spending of World War II. The economy continued to expand after the war, though, because of policy changes in the 1930s that reversed widening inequality and spread the benefits of growth. Collective bargaining, the 40-hour work week, the minimum wage, Social Security, and then after the war, wider access to higher education. So what can be done now to reverse widening inequality? Well, first, award tax cuts to companies that link the pay of their hourly workers to profits and productivity, and that keep the total pay of their top five executives within 20 times the pay of their median worker, and impose higher taxes on companies that don't. Next, raise the minimum wage to half the average wage, and expand the earned income tax credit. Increase public investment in education, including early childhood education, and allow college students to repay the cost of their higher education with a 10% surcharge on the first 10 years of income from full-time employment. And pay for all this by adding additional tax brackets at the top and increasing the top marginal tax rate to where it was before 1981, at least 70%. Even the rich would do better with a smaller share of a rapidly growing economy than a large share of one that is barely growing at all. Our political leaders in Washington have for now chosen supply-side austerity economics over Keynesian economics, and that's bad enough. Their inability or unwillingness to do much or anything about widening inequality will prove a larger error. Thanks.
All right. And again, that was Robert Reich. And he was talking about the recession and income gap. And throughout this show, we're still interested in how the economy affects young people and what young people's role is in the economy. And we have a piece that we're going to be listening to. It's from Youth Radio, which is based out of Oakland, California. And they did this piece during the height of the recession, asking youth how the economic crisis impacted their lives. Before we go ahead and listen to that, I just want to remind you to call in with any questions or comments. The number is 780-4909. That's
780-4909.
And now
the recession
as it is already making a big wave when it comes to education. A lot of high school students are having problems trying to get in, and those of us who are in college are having problems trying to find funding. So this is going to prove to be a pretty sticky couple of years.
Well, just a little bit of technical difficulties, but that's fine. Going off of the piece that we heard before about Robert Reich talking about, you know, Congress and the two sides, but in his advice on what we should do, you know, promoting, you know, more early childhood education, raise of the minimum wage, I really like his idea talking about college and how the debt should be paid off within, you know, like within 10 years, like based off, you know, paychecks, which is actually like a similar system that they have in Australia. But I mean, I think all of those are really great ideas. And talking about the minimum wage, I mean, it's $7.50. I'm up to $8 now, which is nice. And hopefully I'm looking towards another raise, but you know, some aren't as lucky as I, and, I don't know. Jules, your thoughts.
So my thoughts on this when, listening to Robert Reich's video was that another thing that he talked about was like the funding behind it, because I mean, yeah, I mean, we have a good plan on how to recover, but where's the money going to come from? And I think one of those like controversial issues is just like, is like, you know, who's going to be taxed, and you know, how high should the taxes be? And I feel like, you know, when it comes to taxing, you know, the top 1%, it seems that there's like, you know, a lot of, you know, headbutting and like, you know, controversy and fury behind it. But the thing is that what I loved about like hearing Robert Reich, the point that he made was that even like, you know, even with the top like, you know, 1% or like, you know, or, you know, or upper class in general being being taxed, like they're, you know, not only would, you know, would people in a, you know, in a less financially stable position be, you know, brought up, but then also, you know, the upper class would be, you know, brought up too. Their economy would grow rather than having a lot of money and not have it grow at all.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And I know often when I think of the economy, like, I feel like spending is a large part of that. For myself, I'm pretty, like, as far as like my personal savings, I do not spend. I mean, the biggest things that I spend on is, you know, my car, paying for gas and car insurance and all of that. And then that's mostly it. And then, I mean, I don't really, you know, buy a lot of like clothing or anything like that, but I do love food. But I mean, just this year I got like a checking account. So now I have a debit card, and it's, like, as I was kind of talking about earlier, like, it's really interesting having that, like, electronic form of money. And, we are going to try listening to the youth radio piece again. Again, this piece talks about youth voices in the economy, and it was done at the height of the recession. But
the recession, as it is already making a big wave when it comes to education. A lot of high school students are having problems trying to get in, and those of us who are in college are having problems trying to find funding. So this is going to prove to be a pretty sticky couple of years. Hopefully in the next 2 or 3 years or so, the recession will start to reverse itself and more money will come back in, and then money can be returned to education. But education is going to go a little downhill for those who rely on like public assistance when it comes to health care. And a lot of youth do. A lot of young people are going to be going without health care. Jobs are leaving left and right. Young people need jobs, summer jobs, jobs during school to pay for books, clothing, and things like that. We're already, as students, in the poorest parts of our lives, and we're about to get a lot poorer before we start to experience some kind of income intake with jobs.
My name is Asira Shabazz. I'm 15, and I live in New York City. The recession has impacted me because I hear about it a lot at school. A lot of people are running around. They're like, oh my goodness, what's going to happen to my finances? How am I going to take care of myself? Like, I hear lots of old people, elderly people talking about how they're going to pay for Social Security. And there's lots of young people worrying about, like upper class. Oh, what about, you know, my inheritance? How will this affect, like, my financial situation? But then again, there's also a lot of people who it doesn't affect. So you still see the same people talking about, oh, I wanted this and I got it, even though it's X amount of dollars, blah, blah, blah. For me, I don't know. It mostly really hasn't impacted my financial situation. It's largely the same. I still live on a budget, the same budget I did before. So that's one thing I do.
My name's Fernando Bustos. I'm from San Lorenzo, California, and I'm 17. The recession has affected me in my house. We spend less, and we have to save more money since we can't, like, buy all these brand foods and at these high prices right now. And since my dad was laid off of work a couple months ago, now we have to adapt to this new way of living and saving money.
Hello, my name is Cheyenne Johnson, and I'm 16 in Atlanta, Georgia. Well, the economic crisis has affected me severely because I'm trying to find a summer job, and it's kind of hard because, you know, McDonald's, Burger King, all the fast food places are taken by adults who are trying to find a job barely. And I want to work so badly because my mom, she's making me pay for my school clothes, well, half of them, and then I'm trying to buy a car. My mom's always the one who works hard, and we can still make it because she has two other jobs and she's looking for a third one, you know, and it pays off in the end, so she works hard.
My name is Devin Glenn. I am 16 years old and I live in Rosebud Island, New York City. The recession has impacted me in that I really don't think that I'll be able to pay for college. My family doesn't have the money to pay for the colleges that I want to go to. And this situation that we're in right now doesn't seem to be getting any better in the next couple of years. And hopefully it won't get any worse, because that would just be disastrous.
All right. Now we have a caller. We have Andrew from South Portland. Do you have a question or comment for the show?
Hi. Yeah, actually, I was listening to the talk earlier about the economics and how it all works, and I personally do think I'm more on the Keynesian side, but I do think we have to consider, you know, the economy is kind of like a living creature. It works and then it doesn't work. You know, it's a cycle. What happens is, you know, it'll crash and it will come back. And in all honesty, a lot of the things that we do to try and help the economy in the long run will just help, you know, it will backfire. And I do think the minimum wage could be higher, but I also have looked into and heard that actually lowering the minimum wage would give workers the opportunity to say, you know, I'm worth this much. If you're not willing to pay me this much, then I'm going to find another job. You know, I think really the way to get the economy back on track is to give the power to the employees instead of the employers.
It's an interesting take.
Andrew, I want to ask a question. So by giving the power to the employees instead of the employers, what alternatives would there be? And not just, raising the minimum wage, but what about more self-sufficiency, like more independent workers? Whether you're going for a small job or doing like a worker co-op, a local business or a sustainable business.
So, what ways would help workers? Or
well, yeah, I guess is I mean if So you were saying that lowering the minimum wage will allow employees to decide their, like, you know, their own wage. Do you think it would also, like, on sort of maybe the reverse side, do you think it would be beneficial for, as, like, with worker co-ops to have employees invest into the company as more of, as a sort of a compromise between the employer and the employee, because both are now invested?
Oh, of course, yes. I think it's always extremely good to have, you know, your workers actually invested in the business, you know? I mean, I'm the manager of a store, and, you know, hire a lot of teenage workers because they're cheap and they can work on the weekends, which is really what we need. But, you know, they're not really committed to the store, you know? They're not involved. They really don't always, you know, want to take that extra step to do better at their job. And, you know, it could be because they don't see any incentive or any pressure to. But I think the more you can get your employees involved in the business, the better employee they're going to be, making them more productive, and you can save money and they can make more money. And I think it's the cycle of all of that that's really could help the economy as a whole. It will take a long time, obviously. But I do think having your employees, you know, physically, emotionally, and, you know, financially invested in the company is
worth it. I think that also brings up a point between, like, the difference between a job and a career. Yeah. But unfortunately, we are out of time. Thank you, Andrew, for calling.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew.
Wrapping up,
we wanted to thank our engineers, Trenton Johnson, and also Mr. Henry Jones. And thank you, Megan LaSala, for keeping us on track.
Thank you, Jules, for co-hosting with me. Again, Jules Finard, and I'm Iris Sangiovanni. Tune in next week as we discuss agriculture. There's a lot of big things involved with that. So thank you for tuning in to Blunt Youth Radio, and up next is jazz.
Thank you for listening to Blunt Youth Radio.